I'm sure we'll be fine.
Wait, someone's ringing my doorbell. Give me 1 second.
They were supposed to call you, maybe. And the Oscar for Best Doopity Doop Doop Doo goes to... What is the best Adam Sandler movie besides Punch Drunk Love?
I'm Katie Rich, and I've got to stick up for The Wedding Singer, though that might mostly be out of nostalgia, and not nostalgia for the 80s, but for 1998.
Hey, it's me, Dave with a 7, and I think that Billy Madison is the best Adam Sandler movie, because it's one of the few Sandler movies that he got to make, and he didn't have to have built-in box office expectations.
I'm Matt Patches, and I'm going to go with Punch Drunk... I'm going to go with Big Daddy because of Scuba Steve and Jon Stewart.
And I'm David Ehrlich, and I'm going to go with Rain Over Me because in between all of the usual Adam Sandler idiocy, the movie was essentially just 2 hours of him playing Shadow of the Colossus.
There have been recent developments regarding Operation Kino.
Hey, I just met you, and this is crazy, but here's my number.
It's a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Operation Kino for the week of Friday, June 15th. This is the week that sees the release of two summer movies that do not have the same kind of anticipation as Prometheus or The Avengers or some of the other things. It's Rock of Ages and That's My Boy. That's My Boy obviously inspired our lightning round question, and we will review Rock of Ages later on in this week's episode. And from there, we'll have a segment 3 that has nothing to do with Adam Sandler, thank God. We'll be talking about the kind of mini flap that's emerged over the movie Lola Versus, which I talked about briefly last week. It's the Greta Gerwig relationship drama, girl in the city movie. Basically, the filmmakers behind that movie have claimed that it's the older male critics being out of touch with the story of a young woman that have made that movie get such negative reviews. And
they've reversed Jeff Wells did on us.
Basically. We might explain that to enough people. We might not.
I got it.
So we'll talk about how indie movies are made these days and how they kind of rely on critical voices and how maybe older white male critics are keeping us away from better movies, even though Lola Versus, I think we'd all agree, wasn't really a better movie. But we'll get into that more later. But before any of that, of course, we will have tidbits. And we're starting with Dave. I really want to sing right now, but I'm going to let you do it.
Well, I threw a wish in the well, and you can't ask me because I'll never tell. And I'd look to you as it fell. And now you're in my way, Katie. I want to talk about summer songs. This summer, it's most likely going to be Call Me Maybe by Carly Rae Jepsen, who is a Canadian Idol number 2 finisher whose song was an earworm to Justin Bieber, who recorded a lip sync with Selena Gomez and Ashley Tisdale and got us all in this situation where I can't go anywhere that plays the radio without hearing Call Me Maybe. So I'm giving in. It's Call Me Maybe this summer. But as we're listening to other things, I think I saw Patches tweet randomly, I'm going to say like 2 weeks ago, that he was looking for new summer music as weather here in New York started to change. And I've been having a great time sort of splitting between the most recent Sleigh Bells and listening to some Ultimate Johnny Cash mixes I made a while ago. I don't know, there's something about country and summer for me. I think it's just because that's when I'm like emotionally stable enough to put up with it.
Nothing says summer like hurt.
Well, let's not get into different versions of hurt and which one I think is better. I want to talk about what you guys listen to during the summer. And specifically, David, I think, has some more recent things to add to us. But in that case, I want to start with Katie and Patches, because I just want to see what you guys have to say about summer music listening.
I will hand that off to Katie.
I heard Carly Me Maybe in a baseball stadium last week, and that seemed like the ultimate saturation point in which we will never get away from that song.
You know what's interesting
about that song
is that how old do you think she is? And if you know, don't say.
I thought like 18.
Right. She's like 27.
Wow.
I was reading something about how she's kind of passing herself off as a tween to kind of fit in with the Disney Channel. Because that's where it was born. Dave, what is the background of this story exactly? Or this song?
She was like a Canadian American Idol number 2. But she just made an album. She's one of those pop stars that was on a reality TV series, didn't finish first, made an album. This is the single off of it. But it's really just because Justin Bieber found it and elevated it that we're having
Ashley
this conversation.
Tisdale, High School Musical, like lip-synced it or something.
Yeah, and
totally
Justin Bieber and Selena Gomez.
It's a conspiracy. It's a summer music conspiracy.
Let's leave this to future
Justin
scholars.
Justin Bieber rules all of our lives.
To solve all right.
I'm all for Call Me Maybe. I don't want to think about how that matches up with my tidbit last week and what, you know, genres of art I allow to be crap and still enjoy. But what I would like to do is talk to David, who has been talking about how he has some great recommendations for me and you. So, David, let's do it.
Well, I've got some great recommendations for me and me. I don't know how they're going to fall on the rest of you.
It's all Radiohead, David. It can't all be Radiohead.
It is not all Radiohead. Radiohead, as much as I love them and have followed them this summer, not really, you know, what I think of as the ideal of summer music. I don't know. I've been into I think summer is the season for Swedish pop. That's my thing recently. I've been there's a lot of Swedish and some British pop that I think is equivalent to some of the stuff that's ruling the airwaves over here, if airwaves is still the appropriate term, but a lot better written, a lot more catchy, and a little bit more varied. There's the song that I'm most obsessed with, that I've totally gotten my girlfriend hooked on, so it's passed the test, is by this girl named Faye. It was actually on Pitchfork a few weeks ago. It's a song called Water Against the Rocks. It'll be out on iTunes in a few weeks. It's amazing. Also, who else? The Chromatics' new album, they are not Swedish, but their new album is a summer delight. There's a British 19-year-old goth pop singer named Charlie XCX, whose songs Stay Away and her new single, You're the One, I think are
That's like the quintessential David tidbit.
These are not
British
so...
British goth teenager.
These are not so obscure. I mean, they sound, maybe the way I describe them, more ridiculous than they are, but I think that someone like Charlie XCX, for example, was just profiled in Spin pretty heavily. I mean, they're getting out there. And Nikki and the Dove, they're Swedish. Nikki and the Dove are this group with an ampersand, not the word and, that have this single called Tomorrow, which is just pure gold. Pure pop summer gold. And then there's a lot of like old nostalgic stuff. The Chairlift record from earlier this year is amazing.
That's so
summer.
Funny that you were. I was about to recommend that. That was my recommendation. That Chairlift album, Something, is really fun. And it has a lot of upbeat tunes.
It does. It's you may find that a certain. Well, you know, I won't even go there. The Chairlift album is wonderful. And a lot of their friends, like Ice Choir, and who are very sort of an 80s. Throwback, but not 80s in the Rock of Ages sense, but 80s more in like the Aztec Camera sense, are also really good summer music. There's a ton of stuff out there right now beyond what you
and Call Me
David
Maybe.
Wants you to have better taste than Carly
and
Mae
Call
Jepsen.
Me Maybe.
I really
I guess
like
I still stand by
I
Call
really
Me
like
Maybe.
That Carly Mae Jepsen song
as a way of wrapping this up. I want to say that I was really looking forward to English pop star Vivi Brown's album, Lollipops and Politics. She released the single Children in November, and it was supposed to come out in February, but it keeps getting delayed, so it looks like we might get it in July. So if that ends up being as good as I think it will be, that's my future recommendation.
If I can slip one counterintuitive recommendation, it's like really depressing and brooding for summer music, but it's just so good, is The Liars' new album, Wixu. And also the new Dirty Projectors album is really sort of backyard barbecue music. It'd be good.
All right. Good.
All
Moving
right.
on.
Yes. David, you're next.
I am next now that I've agitated, Dave. Well, I have been, I don't know, I get this really condescending attitude sometimes. Sometimes it's expressed, but most of the time internally when I am as guilty of this as anybody else, of obsessively talking about something like Prometheus online for weeks on end, and just a little voice in the back of my head is like, watch a real movie. Although Prometheus is a real movie and one that I enjoyed, but the perfect counterpoint to something like this and see the sort of summer excess and vacuity is the Human Rights the Human Rights Watch Film Festival, which is a traveling film festival that plays predominantly documentaries that deal with human rights issues, and is about to make its major stop at Lincoln Center in New York. Although you don't have to be in New York to see these films, it's toward Chicago and San Diego and Toronto and a number of different places. But they're about to stop in Lincoln Center, and the lineup looks pretty fantastic, and all films that really seem to require our attention, both as film fans and humans. And I wanted to talk about one in particular, which was, full disclosure, not incidentally, made by a sweet mate of mine from college named Katie Wright, who went to Africa and sort of embedded herself in Uganda and made a film about the fight for homosexual rights in Uganda and sort of the very what's the word I'm looking for? It's a very agitated battle over there. I think the Christian right, the extremists, have taken a very hard-nosed approach to homosexuality. I think it's a scapegoat for a lot of the things that are plaguing the country, and it's become very, very violent in a way that hopefully our country will never quite to a pitch that our country will hopefully never quite reach. And Katie, as there's a Kill the Gays bill, which is very popular, not popular as far as its support, but certainly its renown and its infamy.
As in the extent people know about it, not that people around the world are like, yes, exactly. Kill the gays.
If, you know, quite the opposite. In fact, of course, UN and whatnot have been very outspoken in decrying the laws that have been attempted to pass in Uganda and, you know, calling out the world's attention that they're violating human rights and fundamental ones. And what's amazing about this documentary, it follows this guy, David Kato. David Coney was not a gay rights activist. His first name wasn't even David. David Kato, who is a gay rights activist in Uganda. There's a film called Call Me Kuchu. I never even said the name. And it is a remarkable, remarkable portrait of the struggle that's happening there that continues to go on. And Katie was there at a very turbulent time with her co-filmmaker, Malika Zuhali Waral. And this film won a major, major prize at Berlin. It just won Best International Feature at Hot Docs, which is the preeminent documentary film festival in the United States. It's the closing night film at the Human Rights Watch Film Festival. I, you know, who's to say what's going to happen, but I would not be surprised in the slightest if this were nominated for an Oscar. I think it's an extremely important film that brings to vivid life a struggle that we're all aware of, but I think that we tend to see it naturally in American terms, which can be, you know, obviously crushing to our friends and family and the people we know in our lives.
I have a question, yeah. David. So the Human Rights Watch Film Festival is coming to Lincoln Center this month?
Yes, it goes from June 14th to June 28th.
And people outside of New York, are there other options for seeing this? Is there an idea of what kind of release strategy there will be?
I have no idea. I mean, I think that this film is going to be a major talking point as the year goes on. I mean, I think that I don't know what the distribution is in place now, but I think that despite how...
But you think people will be able to see it even if they're not at this film festival?
I think that this and the other documentaries that are playing, these are films that for the most part have distribution. The new Ai Weiwei film is playing there. There's a number of films that you would recognize from their title if you follow this world of filmmaking. And I think these are going to be major films that have reasonably wide theatrical releases and certain campaigns behind them. But, I mean, I think, something like Call Me Kuchu, it's the only one I can speak to. It's the only one I've seen. But, you know, my relationship with relationship in the traditional sense with the filmmaker, notwithstanding, I haven't talked to her in forever, but, this is a movie that everyone really, really should see, regardless of how much they think they might be in touch with what's happening over there. I think just to visualize it and make it a little bit more immediate, does a world of difference. It makes you sort of realize just how urgent the situation is and how urgent the call for action is. And I mean, I think this whole film festival is a wonderful antidote to these very self-involved summer blockbusters that sort of sustain their own economies, over the summer. And if you're in New York, I would really recommend joining me there and seeing some of these movies. And if you should go to ff.hrw.org, and you can see all about the Human Rights Watch Film Festival and the various cities to which they are bringing it or have recently brought it. And maybe you can catch some of these films as well. This podcast airs on the 15th. The festival starts on the 14th, so there's plenty of time.
Nice.
I also want to talk about something that has happened in the past, which is the season finale of Mad Men, in that it aired last Sunday and it takes place in the 60s. I'm really double meaning like that. At this point, I feel like I write a lot about the Mad Men finale, but I haven't really talked about it. I caught up on it late. I only caught it the 24 hours after it aired, which these days is unbearable because everyone on Twitter just wants to spoil everything about television for you.
Say, you were like, oh, you assumed that I didn't watch Mad Men because you never see me talk about it on Twitter. I was like, well, I'm just
I know.
I'm
well,
just
that's
not
true. David
asshole.
Tries to keep off of it. Whereas if I don't catch Mad Men on Sunday, I spend Monday just trying to selectively look through my Twitter feed and without getting spoiled.
4 minutes of spoilers from the season finale of Mad Men coming up. Warning. This is your warning. Skip ahead 4 minutes. See patches.
Anyway, I had a small... usually I watch Mad Men and kind of go through it and watch it and enjoy it and then go read other people's writing to be like, oh, there are the big themes that it was exploring in this episode and kind of pick up on, you know, thematic resonance between episodes and character arcs. But this final episode, I thought, really hammered home a lot of the themes of the season in a way that even for me, who doesn't usually dig into things like this, was kind of like, all right, I've gotten there. I don't really need you to say this out loud for me. What bugged me in particular, so Pete Campbell's big speech to Alexis Bledel in the mental institution, where he basically kind of in the ruse of pretending to talk about somebody else, says everything that's wrong with his life and everything that he's sad about. And it just felt kind of like he was saying out loud all the things that had been in subtext throughout the entire season. And there was something about that also in a lot, even in the visual shots that came in the episode, like a lot of like the shot of all of Sterling Cooper kind of standing at the precipice in this empty office without Lane and kind of seeing them looking off into the future alone. There was just a lot of surface level stuff that I thought had been really under the radar throughout the entire season. And I don't really want to write off the entire season for that because I thought it was really brilliant. But
it was the best season of Mad Men that's ever aired. I'm fairly sure that
that's... Yeah, it was an incredible...
I concur.
I have a really hard time remembering individual seasons. Like, I don't remember what happened in each individual season and kind of need to go back and look. But, I mean, every episode this season kind of blew me away in its own way. And I was kind of bummed to see it go off on a pretty didactic note. And Dave, I think you agree with me on this, right?
I most definitely do, but we were going to throw to David. Are we punishing him? Because he does agree with you.
I thought you were going to agree with me, and then David was going to rebut us to wrap things up.
I mean, I was going to try to end on a you know, positive note, but I mean, yeah, exactly what you said. The toothache didn't need to be there. Matthew Weiner is not a good director of television, and
but he's an excellent showrunner.
He's a fine showrunner, and he's done a great little meta look inside what it is to create a TV show and sell it to people this season. But he is not a good director.
This may not have been his finest moment, but I think that if you look over the best episodes of Mad Men, you'll see his name in front of a lot of the. Under the credits of a lot of the best episodes of the show.
That's possible, and I think you could also debate that. I just am not, I'm not a big fan of Mad Men, which is so good at being ponderous, suddenly deciding that it needs to hit me over the head by giving Don this toothache and this abscess that if he would have left it alone for such a... you know, a little bit longer, they'd have to take his whole jaw off. They'd have serious consequences.
Well, and at the same time, it was like, what exactly is the tooth? Like, it's not even like it was a specific thing. It was like, oh, Don Draper, you're hiding your secret past and you're kind of a bad person. It was like this weird stand-in for all the things that bug him.
Exactly what it is. It's all the things that bug him. It's that his life's become this monster that sucks out of him, and that's what the whole season's been building to, and I didn't need an actual toothache to have a doctor tell me that.
Ghost Adam shows up and is like, it's not just your tooth that's rotten.
Yeah, that was also a little obvious. Not a big fan of it. David, you want to jump in? You got a minute?
Okay, wow. Well, I adored the season, as we all did, but I actually thought the season finale was very effective. I don't excuse the didacticism, but I actually don't think it was very ruinous. I think that for a season that was as brilliantly layered and plotted as this one was, it could get away with a little bit of heavy-handedness to close out the story, but I also think that having his underlying issues physically manifest themselves in the toothache was not unforgivable, but I thought the episode handled so brilliantly how, with all these tectonic plates of characters sliding about back and forth into and out of each other's lives, how ultimately the final moments of this episode revel and reveal their ultimate isolation, even from each other, even Don and Megan, who had worked together to come together in this marriage, that there was sort of a line crossed when she asked him to audition for this ad, and the shot of him walking away from the set and being at the bar, which has nothing to do with him potentially moving away from this relationship in a sexual way, because this is the one thing that he's ever really needed to hang on, the one thing he's ever, you know, had to lose. But I think that
for the record, you don't think he's going to cheat on Megan, but Dave and I both do.
I think that he very well could or could leave her, who knows, but I think that it would only be fallout from him realizing just how ultimately isolated he was and all the things that he's done from distancing himself from his original identity and adding these people into his Don Draper idea and inviting Megan to knowing his secret, I think was the big thing, and saying like, I was Dick Whitman, I had this past, even after all of
which
that.
Which happened entirely off screen, which was kind of incredible.
Yeah, and all of that, it's still, he still ends the season on the precipice of being alone. So I thought it was fascinating.
Yes.
I thought it was a great episode. I thought it was perfectly down key after all the explosive
stuff. I think we can all heartily endorse this season of Mad Men, and that people watch it whenever it comes back, which may be forever from now, because Matthew Weiner does whatever he wants.
Yes.
Patches.
Oh, yes. I've never seen an episode of Mad Men. Well, if you're still listening and you haven't skipped to a review...
We will time it in the... I'll put the time code in so that people can come back in time for your tidbit,
yes,
which is
very important, because an avid listener and contributor to our Twitter conversations, a man by the name of Chris Cook, Cold Milk on Twitter, has been pushing us to see a movie for a while now, and I finally caught it. It's a movie that played at Sundance to generally positive reviews. I believe Scott Rudin picked it up, and they're trying to turn it into a HBO TV show. The movie is Indie Game the Movie. It's a documentary by two filmmakers, Lizanne Pajot and James Swirsky. I probably screwed those names up. Forgive me to two of you. But they did this film, kickstarted it, unbelievably, and got the internet together, and they were like, we want to make a movie about indie gaming, and they did, and it's actually pretty great. I do think you need maybe a little background in video games to fully appreciate it, so Katie, I'd be interested for you to eventually see this film.
I plan to. I have the download. It just didn't work out for me today.
But it basically follows four indie game creators, and you know, a way a game is made now, if you play like Halo 4, 200 people work on Halo 4 to get that game made and designed and look gorgeous and whatever. But there's some people who are driven to make games on their own creative terms, and like movies, you have to go indie. So it's one or two people sitting down and programming and designing and making a game possible. And the games that they profile in this documentary, you can actually play right now. One is called Braid. Another is called Super Meat Boy, which is like a platformer, kind of like Mario. And another one is Fez, which is also another kind of platforming game, but has some 3D elements to it. And they follow these different creators. Basically, the guy who created Braid, Jonathan Blow, had already made the game and become a phenomenon. He's the one who really kicked off indie gaming as like, you can download this onto your Xbox and play it. And this guy can make $5 million doing it all on his own. And it's kind of extraordinary. And people are taking that risk and making it possible. So the two filmmakers follow the creators of Super Meat Boy and the sole creator of Fez, Phil Fish. And their kind of bumpy road to getting these games created. And, you know, it's a lot like indie films. And if you have a background or a knowledge of that, you know how turbulent those experiences can be trying to get something made. And for an industry that is coping with not being taken seriously and not being taken, you know, as an artistic endeavor, you know, Roger Ebert famously goes on record saying, you know, video games are not art. Well, to these guys, they really are, and they mean something, and they're about storytelling, and they're about being creative. And that's what I was really kind of enamored by with this documentary. It's a little overlong. It's a little I think it thinks it's more important than perhaps it really is. These emotional stories, they could kind of streamline it a bit, but they really are compelling, because this one guy, Phil Fish, who created Fez, he premiered it in front of an audience 4 years ago. And I think it just came out. The documentary says that it might come out in 2012, but I think he got it out in the last month or so. And it took him 4 years. And he won an award for, like, best game 4 years ago. And people on the internet have been asking, like, Phil, where is this game? Where is this game? And he had legal troubles, and he had design troubles. And there was one guy working on this game by himself to try and get it made. And in the documentary, the most frightening part is that a certain point that they're talking to him, and he's like, if I don't get this game out, I'm going to kill myself. And he also has legal troubles with a former partner, and who's trying to prevent him from putting the game out. And he says, if I don't get this game out, I'm going to kill this guy. And that's what scares me. But also, I think that's uniquely gaming, because they're, you know, I don't want to call gamers introverts, but I think that the people who, you know, the guys who created Super Meat Boy, Edmund McMillan and Tommy Refinis, I believe their names are, they talk about how they grew up in Santa Monica and they're not part of the beach scene and they're not part of this scene and that scene. You know, they stayed in and played video games, which is perfectly reasonable because now they're creating their own games. But it's an sit at your computer for 12 hours a day between 4 p.m. and 4 a.m. programming kind of job. Whereas, you know, filmmaking might take you outward. I think that's why so many people look down on it. And Indie Game is a really revelatory documentary, if only for that. And I can understand why someone like Scott Rudin might be so interested in this story, because it seems so unmined. If you're into the gaming scene or the mobile gaming scene, as I know Dave and David has beaten Braid. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
You know, you might, it might be so covering some ground, but I think from an emotional level, as a portrait of creators, it's a really, really interesting piece of documentation and clear evidence that gaming is an art form that is only beginning to be tapped as it comes into auteurship and the hands of auteurs.
I mean, we didn't talk about E3, which I was thinking about doing, but especially in a year when they've reinvented Lara Croft to be like a whiny rape doll, I'm very happy that indie games are not having those issues with PR, and they're not dealing with Wii U interfaces. They're the few games that are actually concerned about giving us good game dynamics, and that's why I think this indie game sounds interesting to me.
The other thing is that you can put 4 years of your life into something and see it fail, and the documentary is very tense. I'm not going to tell you who succeeds and who fails. Even if the games come out, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean that they are success. You can be shelved in the back of the Xbox Live Arcade. You know, there's a million titles there. It's a very difficult realm to compete in, especially when you're competing against like Street Fighter 4 or that sort of thing. So it's a very compelling narrative, and I would highly recommend it. It just came out on iTunes and on demand and that sort of thing this week, and Lizanne and James are like working their butt off to try and get this in front of people's eyes. So, and people want it because they kickstarted it, so it's really cool.
Yeah, and you could pre-order it on Amazon and on iTunes, I know off the top of my head, so you should do that.
Awesome. So yeah, check it out. Indie Game, the movie.
All right. I think that does it for Tidbits. Listeners, we just met you, and this is crazy.
But here's my number.
Here's our number.
Call me maybe.
But only after this music break. Looking for this, but now you're in my way. Your stare was holding red jeans, skin was showing. Hot night wind was blowing. Where you think you're going, baby? Hey, I just met you.
All right, this week on Operation Kino, we're reviewing Rock of Ages. Those of you playing our drinking game, I have not seen this movie, and neither has Katie, so we're going to let Patches and David take on this film adaptation of a 2006 Broadway sort of, I guess, mix of popular
jukebox
songs of a certain jukebox show.
Jukebox
That's
musical.
The way to put it.
Yes.
It stars Alec Baldwin, Tom Cruise, Catherine Zeta-Jones, and other people who are less important. Who liked this movie more? Patches,
I'm
going to guess.
I liked it more.
Let's start
David,
on the positive.
Before the show, was referring to it as the worst thing he's ever seen, much like most of the movies that come out during summer season. Not to say that David ever exaggerates, ever.
I never exaggerate.
No, never, never. Yeah. But I did not like this film, but I am going to remain slightly more positive than David, so let me begin. Obviously, it is a jukebox. Rock of Ages is a jukebox musical, which for me works against it almost automatically because it's just reverse engineered, and the whole film feels that way. It's just this smatter of like different scenes and different relationships and different characters, and the whole point is to set up for each of these individual kind of late 80s rock tunes. So we see Alec Baldwin and Russell Brand, they're running this Hollywood rock club. Julianne Hough from Dancing with the Stars, and this other guy, Diego Boneta, who I believe may also be from Dancing with the Stars.
As far as I know, Diego Boneta was, much like the lead in Adam Shankman's Hairspray film, cast as a result of a blind casting call from thousands of people from around the world.
Which gives me no hope for the entire world, because he is not very good in the film. But him and Julianne Hough are these two aspiring musicians who meet at the bar. They both end up working there. She's a girl from like Oklahoma who wants to make it big in Hollywood, and they kind of have a relationship and fall in love. And then there's Tom Cruise, who plays Stacy Jacks.
Stacy Jacks.
Yeah, this old
three X's.
poison rocker hair metal guy who is at the end of his career. He's about to begin a solo career, and he's a total kind of burnt out rock star type.
Stacey Jacks
in another universe. And Catherine Zeta-Jones, as Dave mentioned, plays who knows a part that feels injected into the entire script. She's like this politician's wife who wants to bring down rock and roll for some reason, Footloose style, but comes in the beginning, stays out of the whole movie, and then comes in the end. She's useless, and as David may describe, apparently that was the whole point. She really serves no purpose and was injected last minute. But again, for me, as I know that I come off as a musical purist, but I was ready to open up for these songs. They're not really my cup of tea, you know, like Hit Me With Your Best Shot and Bon Jovi and that sort of thing. They're not really my songs. I think some people really treasure them and probably love drunkenly singing them at karaoke, but that is not my thing. And I really did not like a lot of Rock of Ages because mostly it's about these people singing these songs. And I've had many people tell me, too, that the live show is a lot of fun. You get beers, and you're there, and people are singing and screaming these songs, and that does actually sound maybe like a hoot, but this is overly processed lip-syncing with no drama in between, very little comedy. Alec Baldwin and Russell Brand play this couple dudes who are running this rock joint, and they have some funny dynamic because they're trying to keep it alive. Paul Giamatti is in the movie as Stacey Jacks' manager. And he has some funny parts. And but really, at the end of the day, it's so bland, it's so flaccid because it's trying its best to shoehorn these songs into the narrative that there's really no thread to be interested
Batches,
in.
You know,
and
you
because
get me,
you can't really feel the raw power of the music, it's pointless.
You know, you get me all hot and bothered when you say the word flaccid. I mean, I think that you hit the nail on the head in two respects. One, in talking about how the show is sort of, or the film rather, is sort of doomed to fail because it was reverse engineered. You know, they stuff a plot between all these obviously pre-made songs. It's often the case in jukebox musicals like this. But I feel like they were so compelled or committed to include so many songs that it really prohibited the inclusion of any plot. The songs never feel dramatically or narratively tied to any of the characters. They always, no matter what lengths or often not lengths the film takes to justify their inclusions, feel completely arbitrary. And as a result, you never have any sort of, I mean, the characters are traces to begin with. I mean, they're complete wisps, but at the same time, they don't even make an attempt for you to care about who they are or understand what they're doing.
I will say that sometimes that's on purpose and it does serve the comedy. I think in the first quarter of this movie, I was pretty on board with it because it felt like 80s movie, you know, in the vein of like Date Movie, or it just felt like a spoof and really did not take itself seriously.
I mean, it takes place in
absurd stuff in this movie.
It takes place in like the Epcot Kingdom country of the 80s. You know, it's like it's,
they're all drinking Zima. There's no drugs at the rock club.
It doesn't feel anything like the 80s. I mean, I was 6 years old when the 80s ended. But from what I gather, it feels nothing like the 80s. It certainly doesn't have the spirit of the music that I know from the 80s. But anyways, of course, it was shot in Florida completely on sound stages. And I think the artificiality of the world of the film is intentional. It's sort of to play up the this
feels
homage
very 80s.
And feel back of it, and that works to some extent, but it's also airless and suffocating. And there's no air supply. actually, I wouldn't even know if there's air supply because there's so many songs and they're all so generic. These songs that had some personality, at least when they were sung with their original artists, are all completely gutted of that when they're put into these very Broadway show-tuney renditions of them by people like Diego Boneta, the terrible. He is awful. I mean, he's extraordinarily awful in the main role, and he's got a very Hollywood presence. And Julianne Hough and Tom Cruise acquit themselves just fine. Paul Giamatti actually does even better than
Tom
that.
Tom Cruise gets to play up his own personality a bit and spoof himself, and I thought it was kind of funny. He has one scene with Alec Baldwin, which I think is quite hysterical, about like the fire phoenix rising from the fire, and he's like caught up in the grandness of his own personality.
But it all feels so inert. The singing is uniformly not good, and it can be fun. I mean, I think karaoke is the other major touch point that you got to earlier, where the thing about karaoke is that you have to be somewhat involved in it. You have to feel as if you can get up there or at least cheer on the people who are singing. And this is like 3 or 4 hours. I mean, it really is interminable, especially when Julianne Hough meets Mary J. Blige and becomes a stripper or something. I don't know what was happening. I really, at that point...
A stripper where they don't strip.
Yeah, I mean, God, no. There's nothing even close to resembling sex appeal in this film, which, as I gather...
Wait. You mean Tom Cruise singing Pour Some Sugar on Me wasn't all you needed?
But it's all like, even for Tom Cruise, you know, if I were the sort to, you know, have my eyes widen at the sight of him shirtless, it's so counter to the bald and brazen sex appeal that characterized all these bigger than life personalities of the 80s. I mean, it's so sexless, it's so plastic. That,
you know what? It's really dry.
Yeah.
Does that? It's. I kept thinking during 80s movies, like those classic 80s movies where people are dancing and sweating and like just being on top of each other, and it's really hot and romantic. This movie doesn't have any temperature whatsoever.
There's actually a scene where Tom Cruise sings "I Want to Know What Love Is" into Malin Ackerman's asshole. That's actually a thing that happens in this movie.
It's true.
And it feels so.
And into her vagina.
Right. And it's
because he opens up her legs and sings into her.
Well, I mean, is it hard to direct into one of those when you're singing "I Want to Know What Love Is"?
Maybe not, but I think that in the world of this film, I mean, he's a sex god, and this is supposed to be like this mind-blowing experience for her, where she gets in touch with her womanhood and all this junk. She's a Rolling Stone reporter, and it feels so. It's supposed to be silly, of course, but it feels so dry, as Patch has said. It feels just so inert that it defeats itself, and it's watching other people do karaoke and being paid a lot of money for it, and with no escape route. And it's a really insufferable experience. I think that the music, it's all counter to the spirit of the music that I think it's trying to celebrate, because it's all karaoke renditions or Broadway renditions of these songs, and they all feel like the same song. They all, to me at least, lose the spark of what made them interesting in the first place. And so when the lead character is torn between joining a boy band in the beginning of the New Kids on the Block era in the early 90s, or sticking with his journey roots, it's supposed to be like these badass rocker roots, but he's writing Don't Stop Believing. It's like, well, you sort of lose any of the tension here, or certainly all of the message, because the boy band shit that you're selling out for is no worse than the music that you're supposedly true and honest that you want to sing on stage.
I think that's where the movie falters, because it can't decide if it wants to be a total spoof of 80s, which it hits in some ways, especially with the ensemble older cast, like Russell Brand, Alec Baldwin, Paul Giamatti, even Malin Ackerman. I mean, they get some funny bits when they don't have to be and share scenes with the lead two and try and or Tom Cruise, really, and try and hamfist whatever narrative, the semblance of a romance that they have. Like, that stuff is dead on arrival. The comedy, though, I think really works sometimes.
I mean, it's unfortunately, I think it's completely overwhelmed by all the stuff that doesn't. I mean, these moments, these scattered moments, the stuff between Alec Baldwin and Russell Brand is ultimately okay. Paul Giamatti always does okay. But I mean, I think the movie is so long and so, I mean, it's really difficult to recommend to anybody. And I thought that this, you know, I've tried to vet this statement as best I can by looking over what I've seen this year, but I have a really hard time of thinking of a less pleasant experience in a movie theater, even films that, or at least from this year, even films that I thought were lesser, if you know, push came to shove and I had to rate it on some sort of quantitative scale, may have had some redeeming values. They may have had some attempts to what they were trying to do. But even the choreography in this, for example, Adam Shankman, who was a choreographer, did not choreograph this film. He left it to somebody he trusts. But even the choreography is completely dull and unimpressive.
There is one moment that I enjoyed choreographically and musically speaking, and that was Catherine Zeta-Jones's dance number to Hit Me With Your Best Shot. But that, again, it's totally just inserted into the film. It serves no purpose whatsoever. As a standalone moment, I would rather watch this moment in like on a YouTube video,
exactly.
Which you can because it's on YouTube already. but like this is a movie better served in pieces as music videos than it is as like Funny or Die music videos of famous people singing ridiculous songs, and it is a feature length.
I mean, this
film
feels like a Funny or Die video that everyone was convinced was a real thing. But I mean, Catherine Zeta-Jones, who plays I want to say Walter Cronkite. That's not right. Plays what's his name? I mean, Walter White, his real name in real life in the world in which we live.
Bryan Cranston.
Bryan Cranston's wife, and you just see Bryan Cranston, and you're like, but do things, but he has nothing to do. I don't even think he gets a song. He just, like...
Isn't he the mayor of Los Angeles?
Yeah.
Yes. So, but he has some funny bits, too. It's just... The problem is it's 2 hours long, and it's an 80-minute movie at best.
Oh, at best. I mean, this is...
And it just... It doesn't have anything going for it. It's too padded. There's even some great cameos that I won't spoil. Some people I love, and I was laughing hysterically when they popped up, but it's so padded by all this obnoxious other useless... narrative stuff.
I think it actually sort of gets negative mileage from the cameos by having these people who come in do so little. I mean, they could have been played by extras and the movie would not have lost anything. I mean, they get Will Forte, for example, spoiler alert, to essentially direct traffic.
Hold the microphone.
Yeah. it's
he's playing his SNL announcer character, essentially.
Well, there are other music people in there, supposedly Nuno Bettencourt of Extreme. And Porcelain Black of Porcelain and the Traps and Sebastian Bach are around.
Sebastian Bach of Gilmore Girls?
Skid Row.
Period.
Skid Row.
He was a major character in Gilmore Girls, the later seasons.
Well, you would never recognize them because it's also, I think it's awfully shot, too. Like, I can't really tell what's going on.
Ugly film.
It's unfortunate. I mean, it's trying to riff on the 80s aesthetic, and it just flops. It can't pick a direction and go with it.
Yeah.
To wrap up, I will say that... I will repeat my tweet from after, because even days later, I still agree with this, that I think I've ripped farts that rock harder than Rock of Ages.
Wow.
So there you go.
Wow. I mean, that's difficult to top. But I would just say, you know, I say a lot of nasty things about a lot of topics on the show. But, I mean, and there are films that I've been even harder on, maybe. But I really – this is not one of those movies where you go and you maybe have a different viewpoint, although you might. But, I mean, I really cannot – articulate how much I think this is just like a really difficult experience to endure. I mean, I think it's just a really unpleasant slog for anyone. If you're considering taking your friends and family or whomever to go see this, I think you're gonna be paying a lot of money for an excruciating time that could be better spent doing almost anything else. So just even singing these songs to yourselves in your car, you know, break out your Winnie, you know, open the sky roof, do whatever you have to do. And have a good time, because you certainly won't in this film.
Well, it sounds like no one should see Rock of Ages. Aww. So let's take a fantastic Better Than Rock of Ages music break, and we'll see you all back for segment 3. Your Santa's holding ripped jeans, skin was showing, hot night, wind was blowing. Where do you think you're going?
Okay, so for segment 3, we are visiting a debate that has interested a lot of film critic types over the last week, and we think will interest you guys, too. You might remember last week I talked about the movie Lola Versus, which stars Greta Gerwig. It was distributed by Fox Searchlight. It's an indie movie that's distributed by a subsidiary of a major studio. I don't really know how we define those movies these days. But the filmmakers behind it, Zoe Lister-Jones and Daryl Ween, made a movie called Breaking Upwards. It was they made it with their own money, tiny kind of definition of indie, and then were hired to make this movie for Searchlight, Lola Versus, which got fairly critically panned. It does not have an overall good score on Rotten Tomatoes. And they issued an open letter to their, I guess, their email list of supporters.
Yeah.
I don't really know how they got
people
that list
of
people.
On the Breaking Upwards mailing list.
All right. So they're people just basically saying, so this whole group of critics didn't get it.
Okay,
like,
okay. Wait, hold on. It says...
You want to quote it? Okay.
The male critics are attacking the film, and our box office really struggled last night. We think this has a lot to do with it being a female-driven comedy about a single woman, and the older male critics don't like messy, unapologetic stories with women at the center. There was a similar backlash against HBO's Girls, at first from men, but we don't have the luxury of a full TV season to change their minds. And then they went on to...
Did they call their movie messy?
Yes,
a
messy, unapologetic story with a woman at the center.
We think critics don't know how to handle a terrible, trite piece of shit that just goes on forever.
Wow.
So. I really enjoyed the Critic Wire commenter who said that Prometheus is always a messy, unapologetic story with a woman at the center.
True.
Which is totally true. So you know, there's a way to talk about this, about the divide of critics versus their subjects, which everyone has agreed they're not as interested in talking about. And so David brought up an interesting idea about how independent filmmakers engage with their audiences these days, and when you kind of have Kickstarter to raise money from the people who are going to see your movie. So, David, how do you feel like these guys are kind of maybe fucking it up?
Well, I mean, I just thought it was interesting that it's sort of become a two-sided coin, with the coin has two sides, whatever you want to say, that in this age of people being able to create films and market films by Kickstarter campaigns and Twitter outreach and viral videos, there was a hilariously terrible and purely unintentionally so rap video made by the Lola Versus crew, which I think may have turned off legions of people, or small legions of people, who were at least considering seeing the film.
At least you.
Well, I had already seen it, so it was too late for me. And now there is actually, right outside of my door, on my corner, there is chalk drawing that says, "Go see Lola Versus." And I want to write, "I did, and you told me to fuck off." So I don't know what to do. But anyway, what I found interesting about this was that with all the opportunities available to indie filmmakers to reach out to their audiences, there's just as much of a risk for engaging with those audiences in a way that might actually hurt your efforts and disengage people and make things more difficult for you. And I think Lola Versus has become the poster child for how not to engage with wider audiences, on top of the fact that it's an almost unwatchably bad movie. So I just wanted to sort of open it up to what people can do, what the proper way to engage with both critics and the general public alike are, if they knew that sending a letter like this to their supporters, the support of their first film, would make it immediate fodder for the press at large and other such topics.
Well, I think the thing is with this movie, and especially with that viral video, which had nothing to do with the movie at all, like, it was just I guess at this point it's like, oh, we have a movie coming out, let's put up our Funny or Die viral video too, because that's what we do now. And it almost seems like it's an ill-conceived move that was planned from the beginning. It's almost like every movie that comes out, regardless of size, is a transmedia project. I even have friends doing small indie films that they're trying to, like, get into Sundance and that sort of thing. And, you know, they're very concerned. I've seen this on, like, indie filmmaking blogs. Like, here's what you do when you're going to start an indie. Get your Facebook page set up. Get your Twitter account. Put up the Tumblr. You know, like, making a transmedia project so that you can reach all your avenues. Now, it makes sense to me on one hand, because it's like, okay, who's going to see this movie? You know, people with indie sensibilities and tastes. And how do you really reach those people? Through social media. But I think because we've seen lots of movies use it in the same exact way, there's now a pattern building, and it's just like people are going through the steps. They're not taking their own project into consideration and how it makes sense to distribute it. You know, there's not a one-fits-all method for putting your movie out there. But
at the same time, I mean, don't you think they have a reason to think, well, getting it out there as much as we can makes the most sense? Like, why not set up the Tumblr for your new indie?
I mean, by doing something like a viral video that has absolutely nothing to do with, that uses gangster rap, like Lonely Island type parodies to sell your unconventional rom-com, like, it just doesn't seem logical to me. You're not talking about the movie. You're not putting the movie first. You're not making it interesting. Yeah. And it seems like to me that if you conceive these sort of things beforehand and it's evident to those people, then you're putting less interest into your movie.
Yeah, I think that, Katie, what you said is exactly the point, that we're sort of at the tipping point for where all of a sudden any press is good press in this sort of transmedia film awareness world is now not necessarily the case, where we expect as much of a film of any size, from a small student film to something as big as a film being released by Fox Searchlight. And when you send out something that's as just unpleasant and unfunny as the video they did, it actually, now it's not, oh, there's a viral video and it's going to bring me into this film's world or make me more aware of it. It's just an active turnoff, because there are so many other films that are attempting to do the same thing that which we can better deviate our attention.
I want to take the position that maybe they know that they have a semi-dud on their hands and this is all well calculated. Here's why. Everything that we've seen has come from the quote-unquote Breaking Upwards team, which is just the dude and the girl. And this Lola Versus is a Fox Searchlight movie. If Fox Searchlight was having trouble, you know, ad spacing Lola Versus, I doubt that we would see the Breaking Upwards team at the forefront of the PR. What this reads like more to me is a large studio's like, you're not doing so well, and the smaller indie crowd realizes that they need to create like an us versus them attitude. There needs to be a group of people who quote unquote get Lola verses that are out there being their street team, and they didn't have it. So now they're finding some ways to stir up controversy in hopes that the people that have seen Lola verses, or the people that are on this mailing list just by knowing who the team is and maybe knowing them personally, are going to go out and be this good press coming from a bad movie.
But you can do that in a positive way. I mean, the internet can be a positive entity. I think that these guys are rubbing the internet the wrong way and not realizing that not everything. The internet doesn't act to explode things in a
well, but
we're talking about
an email that was repinted that was sent to their email chain of people that have agreed to be part with them at this level. And so it doesn't really seem like putting a rap video up that isn't funny does seem like nonsensical unless they want a little bit of hate going their way, which it seems like Rom-Com for Life with two white people and like a crappy rap was going to, you know. It's hard because it's hard for me to look at these people that obviously have enough talent to make movies in general and get Fox Searchlight to pick them up. Like, you know, people playing in the real sphere of movie making. These aren't just, you know, Kickstarter people living in nowhere middle America. They are at least aware that there is a game that they're playing. It's weird that they are looking at this stuff and being like, this is the best we could do. I would
agree with you, but I'm going to liken this to the slime in Ghostbusters 2.
Naturally.
Yeah, all right.
Of course you are.
The internet is the slime in Ghostbusters 2 because it reacts to emotion. And you can either feed it negative emotion, like the filmmakers behind Lola Versus, and attempt to twist it into something and push and get people interested that way, or you can be overtly positive. And I think when you are, the internet reacts positively to you. If you have a mailing list of people who are behind you, then you can feed them something that's going to interest them. They want to see Lola Versus. There are people out there, Rudy Obias of the Auteur Cast, I'll give you that, who loves Lola Versus. Those are the people that you should be putting it into the hands to go out and help you campaign for Lola Versus. Not being negative. There's no sense in that, because it's only going to work against you. I don't believe that all publicity is good publicity.
Well, look, I mean, to sort of negate exactly, well, not negate, but counter exactly what you just said in that last little bit there, I mean, here we are, at least two of us who have seen and disliked this film, talking about it, not only on Twitter and on CriticWire, but on our podcast. And so, yeah, maybe not all publicity is good publicity, and that's sort of the thrust of what we're getting at here. But certainly this film, which was absolutely buried by a smattering of very well-reviewed indies that sort of consumed the same marketplace, you know, Moonrise Kingdom and Safety Not Guaranteed, and then Prometheus dragging in a lot of younger audiences as well.
Oh, also Madagascar, you know, 3, which is probably has the younger audiences.
Of course. Sure. Here we are all talking about this film. So, you know, maybe they're going to wring a few more dollars out of this than they might not. But
we're not attracting people to Lola Versus. Well, I think what would benefit them is to, and for all filmmakers who kind of embark on this journey with a film and interacting with audiences in this day and age, take the Kevin Smith route. Take the Kevin Hart route, I should say, which is, find the people who love.
Wait, do you mean both Kevin Smith and Kevin
Smith
Hart,
and
or
Kevin
did you
Hart
really mean to say Kevin
do
Hart?
Do the exact same thing, which is they discover who their audience is, and they make sure that they have their info so that every time they do something new, those people are back. And if
but
you
that,
attracted
exactly
people with
it.
Breaking Upwards, and if you attract anyone with Lola Versus, keep them in your circle and continue to promote through them, get your film, get this thing that you care about the most, hopefully, back into the public eye in a positive way through those people.
There's a very wise man named Dave Gonzalez who once told me when he was producing a film of mine that the people who are giving you money that are part of your inner circle, that are investing in your Kickstarter, that want to be on your email list, are not investing in your film. They're investing in you. And that seems to be something that the Lola Versus team is conversely leaning on a little bit too hard, because I think that this is not really going to do much to draw attention to their film, or at least positive attention is going to translate to ticket sales. But what it is going to do is it's going to piss off a lot of people who might actually be on the fringes of their circles, who might be investing in these people as people. And a lot of horror stories about Daryl Wien as a person are coming out. I mean, there are comments on the IndieWire piece about how he sends nasty letters back to the rejection letters he receives, and like other sort of unpleasantries where, you know, I don't know him personally, so I can't say, but it sheds this whole thing in a very negative light. And no, I mean, I can quote, I can allude to, but I can't speak myself. But you know, I think that this whole incident is really building a negative vibe around these people, where I think there's a lot less goodwill involving whatever they do next. And of course, Zoe Lister-Jones is on Whitney, so I think everyone, you know, even her parents have probably turned on her at this point. So I think that, you know, so I think that it's just, it's not a very wise move.
One's talking about the movie. There are people who like the movie. We're still talking about promotion here, and I think that's the problem with a lot of the way the movies that we see today are engaging with us, the audience, and, you know, us, the journalist people are a whole nother level, unfortunately. I'm talking about, like, the people listening here. Like, how are they being engaged by these films? I don't think they're being engaged on the right level or having the right relationship with them because of how the internet works and how it's every project is a transmedia project.
Yeah, well, when they don't when they don't have the product to sell, they have to sell the flash. I mean, they have to move around it. They're not, you know, they're not Apple. Their products can't sell themselves. There's nothing in Lollaverses that can be put coherently together into a fetching trailer or series of commercials. Greta Gerwig is their best asset, and she seems, I don't know, her attention seems diverted into other things. But I think that all of the social media stuff, which has enabled films like this to exist, is showing with Lollaverses just how much it can backfire and just, you know, make antagonize the audiences that should be your cheerleaders, or the crowds that should be your cheerleaders. And by, you know, the numbers just don't add up for them. They're decrying older male critics, but you look at the few positive reviews, like I think just over 50% were written by women. The negative reviews, it's about down the line. And the older critics cited are people like myself and Eric Cohn of IndieWire, who are 27 years old. So, and I just think that it's not, you know, no one wins in this scenario.
It's because you don't understand gangster rap.
Of course.
And there's not enough gangster rap in Lollaverses.
I mean, I
want to step out of this for a moment and just step out of Lollaverses, because, I mean, you guys don't know this either, but I'm a couple weeks away from starting a Kickstarter campaign for a TV pilot I'm producing. So my mind's on this a lot, with just like how much...
Your very mention of that has just made this a transmedia sales.
I mean, fair enough, which is, this is...
Oh, is this my cue to gangster rap? Yo, 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 we got a TV pilot.
Here's the thing, I guess, is that there's a line where you want that everybody who donates your project and who gets on board, the second that they're on board, you want to spend all the time possible keeping them on board, because those are the people that are going to get you new people. The people you know are not the people, like, you have to get them on board, and that's like your one job. And then after that, it's just a matter of keeping these relationships up, because you don't get new people by, you know, meeting, you know, very few people are going to wander into a theater and be like, maybe Lollaverses, because everything else is signed out. And then afterwards be like, maybe there's a mailing list I could join. This is all social and this is all friend-based. So it seems weird to come out and bash critics going back to Lollaverses like they did. But if I were in their position where my movie's not doing that well, I might, you know, just try to gather as many people that feel like I feel like the movie's getting a bad trip already, and try to bolster them into my mailing list for the next project. Because those people are now, they're valuable people. They've already written off the critics.
I put up a sex tape. That's,
I mean, that
I
that would work if you'd, I mean, be a Kardashian.
Well, I mean, get ready for the Matt Patches.
With my Twitter handle on it, so people,
I think,
follow
at this
me.
Point, ironically, their best allies, their best hope for their future projects succeeding once they've been funded, are critics, because their critical reputation is shot, and they are doing everything in their power to alienate the people that are in the position to best support them. And so I think that understanding that this the social outreach stuff goes in both directions, I think that they have crossed a line which might not be easy to uncross for them. And so,
well, no, I think if they're I think if their next movie is good, then there will be people who'll be willing to give them a shot. I mean,
but
plenty of people didn't see
Lollaverses.
But now they're in the
worst position imaginable, which is that the next movie actually has to depend on quality.
Well,
which is the last place in the world that anybody.
I mean, I think that our wrap up point should be we wouldn't be having this conversation if Lola Versus was really good. So it's everything should depend on quality, and you only have to get into the spin if it's not good. It's out.
Exactly.
It's true.
Never trust Funny or Die videos.
Mm-hmm.
It's true. Don't go see Lola Versus, and don't piss off your don't piss off critics.
Boycott Lola Versus.
How come I wasn't allowed to talk about how I disliked 50 Shades of Grey again, but we were allowed to harp on Lola Versus for 20 minutes?
But I mean,
because we read Lola Versus and you didn't read 50 Shades of Grey. We saw Lola Versus.
To me, and I can't put words in women's mouths, unfortunately, or else that would be much more effective in many ways of life. I think people should be pissed about this in the way that there was a lot of that backlash against someone like Jeff Wells, and he was saying that, you know, you can't trust women critics who are reviewing The Hunger Games positively. I mean, I think this is exactly the inverse of that scenario, and people need to be upset about this, I think, for it to have weight when they cry foul against someone like Jeff Wells. And I'm certain.
It's true. I'm a 27-year-old woman, and I hated Lola Versus.
Yeah, so power to the white man.
That's the way that every podcast wants to end, with that sentence. Great.
Yeah, I think we should end segment three on that note. Dave, what
and
was
the
our
best,
lightning round?
I'm not going to do that. Since there's another Adam Sandler movie coming out, apparently, what is the best Adam Sandler movie besides Punch Drunk Love? And I think I ended up choosing first. So I'm going to go with Twitter user @ColdMess, who said Mr. Deeds, mainly because it's one of the first movies I remember watching in theaters, and I chose you, Cold Mess, because you were the first one to pick Mr. Deeds.
And because he's a baby.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, Mr. Deeds came out in, 1999?
Tell your friends, Cold Mess, that old white men don't like us, so they should listen to the podcast.
And John Turturro had that,
that was John Turturro as the butler.
Adam Sandler was the one who had the foot that had frostbite from, climbing Everest or something.
Turturro hit it with a chimney thing, I don't know,
great
stoker.
Film. Great film.
I picked @dar_codex. Who made the awesome, awesome choice of Click, saying it was funny and had the emotional gut punch at the end. Maybe. that is awesome.
Did you just choose this to make fun of
that person?
No, I
didn't. I just think it's awesome that Click really clicked with someone.
Finally, a film resolved what's in the Beyond section of Bed Bath & Beyond. Oh. So
That actually is how
Christopher Walken's
control,
back there. It's great.
Amazing. Amazing. You know what? That film deserves a second look from everybody.
Apparently, the three men on this podcast have already seen it.
Oh, boy.
I have not seen Click.
Mm-hmm.
If she came back in sale, I'd see her in anything.
Yes.
So I chose Clooney Disciple, who chose Tie Between Happy Gilmore and the Last 5 Minutes of 51st Dates. And I mainly chose it for the Last 5 Minutes of 51st Dates since I have a soft spot for
that
movie.
Garbage.
I think Drew Barrymore makes Adam Sandler more likable. And I chose Wedding Singer for my lightning round. So
what happens
something
in the
about
last
that
five
team
minutes
up.
Of the film that redeems
they
it?
They play that fucking somewhere.
Well, it's when and she wakes up on the boat and you see them being together, and she just wakes up every morning and he reminds her of what their lives are together. It's sweet. I liked it. Okay. Leave me alone.
I like Memento better. Anyway,
it's very sweet, but at the same time, you're just like, that's not sustainable. Like, you got to find some woman who will remember who you are. That's just reasonable.
All right.
And I chose at Nathaniel Petrov, who just chose, he just said funny people. And I got to be perfectly honest. I think the reason I didn't choose funny people for my answer was because I think that movie is so great that it just didn't even occur to me to pick as this sort of backhanded compliment lightning round answer. I think it's a genuinely great movie, and it's leagues and leagues better than all of his non-Punch Drunk Love movies, including Rain Over Me. And
has anyone on this list seen? Has anyone on this call seen That's My Boy?
Tomorrow. Or
Wednesday in the past. I am not going to see it, so I hope you all enjoy it.
Can't wait. R-rated Adam Sandler, just what I've been waiting for after Jack and Jill. A whole year I had to wait. Anyway,
so that does it for this week's Operation Kino. We will be back next week to talk about, what are we talking about next week?
Something good probably Ted.
Oh, Brave.
Brave.
All right, movies. Movies that I will have seen next week. But in the meantime, tell the people who you are.
I'm Matt Patches. I'm the movies editor of Hollywood.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Mr. M-I-S-T-E-R Patches, P-A-T-C-H-E-S. I've also been telling people that I'm on Tumblr at mattpatches.com. And I'm running another podcast, which you should definitely check out if you watch The Legend of Korra, the spinoff of The Last Airbender with Dave Seven. It's called Republic City Dispatch. It's on iTunes and it's on Tumblr. It's everywhere.
It's hugely popular. You should watch it, unless you're old and white, in which case you probably won't like it.
I'm sending hate mail about that right now.
Hey, it's me, David the Seven. You can find me on Twitter at twitter.com/DA7E, and writing about mostly Marvel properties at latino-review.com.
Hey, this is David Ehrlich. You can find me at movies.com, where I write their Criterion Corner column, and also at criterioncorner.tumblr.com. And at Box Office Magazine, where I write film reviews, and on Reverse Shot, where I'm in the middle of writing a 2,000-word article about Scarlett Johansson's ass.
Mm. Wow. Is it about the stupid Catwoman #0 cover, David?
It is not. It is 2,000 words about the color of her underwear in the first shot of Lost in Translation.
I like it.
And I am Katie Rich. I work here at Cinema Blend, and you can find me on Twitter at Katie Rich, KateyRich. And we talk to you next week. I'll never tell. I looked to you as it fell, and now you're in my way. I trade my soul for a wish, pennies and dimes for a kiss. I wasn't looking for this, but now you're in my way. Your stare was holding, ripped jeans, skin was showing.